The Knoxville Opera is putting together a production of Verdi's Il Trovatore. Performances are, as always, in the magnificent Tennessee Theater and are Friday, April 24th at 8 p.m. and Sunday, April 26th at 2:30. As usual, Maestro Selesky will host an opera preview 45 minutes prior to each performance. Il Trovatore will be sung in Italian with projected English translations. And here to talk with me today are two of the leads in this production, soprano Rochelle Bard, who is singing the role of Leonora, and tenor Jonathan Burton, who is performing the role of Manrico. Welcome to you both. Thanks so much for visiting us here at WUOT.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Well, to begin with, tell us about the characters you are portraying. Who are they?
Leonora, I hate to boil her down to this, but it's easiest to explain. I feel like she is half Juliet from Romeo and Juliet and a little bit of Lucia. So she is self-sacrificing, and she is a good girl. She's sort of a princessy sort of character, which is so much fun to play. Desperately in love with the tenor Manrico, the troubadour, and they're in this triangle. She's just so generous of spirit. She loves him so deeply and is willing to sacrifice herself for him, which inevitably she does.
And who is Manrico?
For me, he's so refreshing because he's what I consider to be a pretty beautiful and noble human being. You know, I'm not playing one of these complicated men like Pinkerton and Butterfly. Can you even root for this guy? You know, this is he's a very pure spirit. He is as well in love with Leonora and maybe even to a fault does what he always knows to be the right thing. He was raised in a gypsy camp. He was kidnapped as a little boy by Azucena and raised, but still, even in the end, he comes out to be a fighter for truth and justice.
Okay, I have to admit that when I was reading the synopsis for this opera, it is a little complicated, although it really involves just, you know, several key themes. But could you summarize the basic plot of the story?
Oh my.
And maybe don't give away the ending.
Don't give away the ending.
It sounds terrible on paper. And that's the thing, like, I was trying to explain it to my 9-year-old stepdaughter, and she got it. If I was able to explain it to my 9-year-old, then anyone can get it. But I think it's the kind of thing where if you see it, it makes sense.
Mm-hmm. It's tough to explain the plot without giving away
yeah.
the ending.
It is.
Sure. She says to Manrico, when he says, tell me the story of what happened when you were younger. She says, oh, I can't believe you've never heard this story. She says, well, maybe it makes sense that you've never heard it. Anyway, when they burned my mother at the stake, I went to get my revenge on them by kidnapping their child. But then I came back and I threw my own kid in the fire because I was so confused. And he says, then I'm not your son? What are you talking about? She says, no. Oh, sorry. Every time I think about this, I get confused. Don't worry about it. You're absolutely my son. So anyway, I want you to go kill the evil count. So he spends the rest of the show going and trying to kill the evil count at his mother's insistence, who is also in love. The fair Leonora.
Who you love.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So they're sworn enemies now. He's anew. Not only is this his rival in love, this is the man that his mother really wants him to run a sword through. Mm-hmm. So this is his mission to the end of the show.
And I do everything I can to save Manrico from certain death because the Count is so angry that his rival has taken his love.
Including becoming a nun.
That's right. Yes, she's so generous. I mean, she's just like, here, take me. She thinks Manrico is dead after the first act, and it turns out not to be true. So she says, I would rather give myself to God and live out the rest of my days than to marry the Count, because that's just, you know, there were arranged marriages. That's where she would end up. So she wholeheartedly decides to join the nunnery, and the Count bursts in and says, absolutely not. He's the evil baritone. He's so fabulous. The cast is really great. And I'm not just saying that because I'm in it and I want it to be good. There's so much talent in these principals. It's an honor to sing with them.
This opera is set in Spain and several of the characters are gypsies, including a gypsy chorus. And I know when I think of an opera set in Spain that involves gypsies, I can't help but think of Carmen.
Right.
And I should note that Trovatore was actually composed before Bizet's opera. How does this opera compare with Carmen? Can we expect to hear traces of Spanish or gypsy music?
Our music director was just saying this morning that Trovatore is like Carmen on steroids. You know, it's a hit parade like Carmen is, where you recognize somehow, you know, all of this music or you've heard it. And of course, the famous Anvil Chorus, which even if you don't know the name of it, you've heard it before, I'm sure. Verdi quotes himself so much in this opera. I hear evidences of Rigoletto and Traviata all over the place in the score in such a beautiful way.
I would say not like Carmen in the way that Carmen sets out to portray Spanish gypsy music. Trovatore doesn't do that, though sometimes when Azucena, the main gypsy character, sings, you can certainly hear the tonality that he uses is invocative of those kinds of idioms. But I wouldn't say he tries to make it sound as Spanish and gypsy as Bizet did.
Can we expect a traditional production, or has the director made any unusual alterations?
I would call it a deeper traditional production. It's traditional in that it's set in the time period that it's meant to be set in by the composer and the librettist. And we don't do anything outrageous in terms of setting or plot liberties with, you know, furtive looks we give each other that would make it seem to contradict the story. But it's also not a surface reading of it. She's gone very deep into the character's motivations.
I think the surprising element that Keturah has added in is the appearance of the ghost of Azucena's mother. She appears as a ghost throughout the show, as well as the child who died in what is supposed to be monster makeup, according to the kid who's doing it. He's very excited. So that's a twist I haven't seen and is totally fascinating. It brings in that almost scary fairy tale feel to it, you know?
Speaking of the stage director, Keturah actually has a dancer's background.
Yes.
Which is perhaps a little unusual for her stage director. Mm-hmm. How has her approach been different when staging this work, if at all?
Well, it has been for me. She talks to me about ballet arms and extending your line and, you know, how to die gracefully. These are things that a director, you know, needs to help us with because she's our eyes and our ears. So she's fascinating in that way. She has great vision.
Well, she's at the most different when she's demonstrating something.
She says, move over, let me be you for a minute.
Yeah, you're like, well, I can't look like that. It's a great balance in that we have the maestro there for the musical purposes and we have her there for the visual purposes. And she's certainly a fan of opera, but that she is more motion-oriented, I think, is very helpful. And otherwise, I consider her to be a very orthodox director. She's a protege of Lillian Groag, who I've worked with before, who is a theater actress and playwright. So she's very much an orthodox director with the added bonus of being great at movement and the idea of motion and movement on stage.
I love that she tries to get us to sort of go beyond the line, and then she says, when you go too far, I'll let you know. We were just staging the Miserere last night, which is kind of almost like a Lucia mad scene moment where she knows that Manrico's in prison and she's losing her mind while these monks are singing this gorgeous chanting music in the background. And she says, feel free to be ugly right now and go too far. And, you know, we've got 5 more times to play with this before we figure it out. And I love that kind of playful quality.
Let's talk about the demands of these roles a little bit. For both of you, this is the first time you were performing these roles?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Is premiering a role daunting?
Oh, absolutely.
Totally.
Absolutely.
Yes. We all are. All 4 of the main principals, and Patrick as well, who's singing the bass baritone. So the 5 principals are all singing this for the first time, I believe. So we've been kind of figuring out together. Maestro in the first week would say, okay, what tempo do you want? And Jonathan would say, I don't know yet. Because we're discovering what works for us, and they've been really patient with us.
In terms of vocal demands, Trovatore is a truly hideous show. Caruso said there's no problem putting on Trovatore so long as you have the 4 best singers on the planet. And I can't say
no
that we're the 4
pressure.
Best singers on the planet, but I was talking to Dana Beth Miller, who's our Azucena, yesterday, and we did a run-through of the second half of the show, which is where a lot of the meatier things happen.
Yeah.
And she says, we're in that place where you start to say, what was I thinking? You know? And, of course, all of your colleagues say, are you kidding? You sound amazing. So it's a process of being beaten and molded. But it is a tough process the first time with a role. And some of them get easier and some of them never do.
What is particularly challenging about this opera specifically?
For me, what would be challenging about this opera specifically is what we call the tessitura, or the average, the overall average of how high the role sits. coupled with how dramatic it is. Mm-hmm. So, in other words, your RPMs are running higher. You can't shift into that higher gear ever and just kind of coast along. All of the music that you're asked to sing is in that heightened state. Mm-hmm. It's not a very long show. It's only 2.5 hours. And the last one I just did, Don Carlos, was 5 hours. So it has a whole different set of problems. But this one is just a scorcher from front to back. Just, it never lets up.
It's so demanding. This role for me is lower and equally high. So I'm I did Norma last year. I'm used to singing Traviata, Lucia, and things like that. So high notes I'm used to. The tessitura of my role is much lower because it's a little bit more intense, and I think Verdi does it that way. So going from a low A, below middle C, to, you know, a high D is not normal in my repertoire. And so that's something I've been playing with, and it's great and challenging and dark, and it adds a whole other element of emotion to it.
Mm-hmm. And the cast is somewhat small as well. I mean, there's 4 or 5 principals, mm-hmm. so not a lot of time to rest in between.
Right.
It's true. I was thinking about that this morning, that this show, more as much or more than any that I can really think of, is truly ensemble casting in the way that there's just one after another, either solo, duet, trio, something that happens. And it's, you can't have any weak characters there.
Right.
Because they all have high demands on them.
So what do you do when preparing a new role? How many hours do you think you spent learning it?
Normally, I worked on Norma for a year. And, of course, that was Norma, and it was the biggest role I've ever done. But that, I mean, I worked on it for a long time. Brian made me memorize it 6 months before the show, just to be sure that I had it all down, you know. Mm-hmm. But normally, 6 months to a year, maybe even longer, because you work on arias, you know, in your lessons and things like that, even if you don't have a show coming up. This one was last minute for me. I'm essentially filling in for someone else that was originally cast. So I've been learning this in 2 months, which is really fast.
Oh, my gosh.
Right.
I didn't know that.
Right.
Wow.
My fiancé and I were on vacation in Mexico, and I listened to the entire opera for the first time on the beach. And I had already told him I would do it. And I said, absolutely, I can do it. It's perfect for me. No problem. And he said, can you really learn it in 51 days? And I said, absolutely. And then I listened to it, and I said, oh, my God. But, you know, I did it, and I had the help of my teacher and coaches at home, and I just made it happen. So this is the kind of thing where I can't wait to sing it again. And we've had a really generous maestro and director who have helped us do whatever we need to do, because this is new to all of us. Did you have more time? You've been having back-to-back operas, so you didn't have more time.
Should I give you my honest answer?
Yes.
Now that I know that the director and the conductor are happy with what we're doing, I'll tell you. I learned this role in 2.5 weeks.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I, of course, have been familiar with this show for most of my classical music listening life, all except for the final act. Because, you know, all the other ones, it's these big famous tunes that we've heard on, you know, highlight CDs. So I was very familiar with it. But I'm the kind of person who can't really learn something until there's a certain amount of pressure or fire. Mm-hmm. And I was going through Don Carlos before this, the 5-act uncut version. And that was such a huge undertaking. And I had a big concert in between there as well that I had to memorize music for, that I only had the time between those two shows to really memorize this one. So I was spending about 10, 11 hours a day.
Wow.
Working on this show.
Oh, my goodness.
And also, if I sit around and mess around with something for too long, I tend to second guess it too much. Mm. I need for my voice to turn into instinct mode over overthinking mode.
Mm-hmm.
So it's definitely the right approach to take an entire year to learn a show. That's what we're supposed to do and what we should do. But if you ask about the process, the first thing for me is the words. I have to be separate from the music. I can't even look at them in the score. They have to be in a libretto by themselves. So then I, if not memorize the words, at least be able to say them very, very fast. And of course, have everything translated and know exactly what I'm saying. Then I can start putting it to music.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's really just a process of repetition.
Jonathan, I understand there's a good bit of sword fighting in this mm-hmm. opera.
Mm.
Did you have to spend a great deal of time learning how to do this?
Luckily enough for me, I spent a childhood fascinated with sword fighting. The Star Wars movies had me from about the time I was 5 years old. So fascinated with all, and I got into, Errol Flynn movies, and there's a guy in Hollywood named Bob Anderson, who's a fight choreographer, who I started following all of his work, and he did things like The Princess Bride. I'm pretty sure it was Bob Anderson. But all of those fantastic sword fighting scenes in there, I used to act out with my friends. There are companies we would order swords from. So I've always been into it since I was young. And if you do Carmen a lot or anything like that, you end up spending lots and lots of hours in fight call going through these types of things. So it's not new to me. But this era certainly has its fair amount of sword swinging.
Rochelle, you have an interesting story of how you came to be an opera singer. You certainly didn't start out as one.
I didn't.
Tell us how you fell into it.
Sure. Falling into it is exactly the right thing to say. I was planning on being a doctor. I have a degree in biology pre-med from Holy Cross in Massachusetts and worked really hard for that degree. And I was a pianist all my life. I played for my sister, who's a fantastic musical theater singer, and just accompanied people in college and choirs and things like that. And I started teaching biology before I was going to take the MCATs and all that jazz. And I decided to do a show on the side, and I sang The Mother Abbess in The Sound of Music, for which the high A at the end of Climb Every Mountain was so hard for me. I remember when I was 21, I was like, oh, I can't sing this high
That's
A.
Hilarious.
Now a high A seems low.
That's middle voice for you now.
But I just remember how hard that was. Anyway, this mysterious gentleman came up to me after the show on the sidewalk and said, what are you doing teaching? Why are you in the sciences? Why aren't you singing? And I said, I don't know. And I didn't know my life path at all. And I started to audition for things and ended up getting my master's at New England Conservatory and getting into Tanglewood. And all of these things I did not plan. When I was a young artist, a fellow at Tanglewood, I would tell people I was a pianist because I didn't have the gumption to admit that I was a singer. I didn't feel like I had the personality for it because I was shy. So I'd just be like, I'm a pianist. Anyway, it just took me a few years to sort of come on board and say, okay, yeah, I'm good at this. This is something I can do. And I love pretending to be other people and playing these wild roles, these extreme emotions. It's just really, it's not what I planned, and I'm so grateful for it.
Well, Rochelle and Jonathan, it's been an absolute pleasure talking with you. Toi, 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 for a great performance.
Thank you.
I've been speaking with soprano Rochelle Bard and tenor Jonathan Burton, who are two of the leads in Knoxville Opera's upcoming production of Verdi's Il Trovatore. Once again, performances are Friday, April 24th at 8 p.m. and Sunday, April 26th at 2:30 and are being given in the beautiful Tennessee Theater. I should also mention that in between these performances is Knoxville Opera's Rossini Festival and International Street Fair. There will be live music, international food and drink vendors, artisans, and much more. That's Saturday, April 25th from 10 a.m. until 9 p.m. in downtown Knoxville. More information on these events is available online at knoxvilleopera.com or by phone at 524-0795.